Hi there. I'm Brother Merrill, and this is Sunshine for the Soul Inspirational Stories. I appreciate you watching today. I have got some wonderful stories. I want to thank everyone that sends stories to me, whether they are from their own life or something that they have read or heard that helped them feel the Spirit. These are the stories we need to share with one another. And I appreciate you sharing your stories with me. You can do it at this email address. Thank you. I also want to thank Irene for sending me this great book by Brother Shumway. It has some wonderful stories, and this is the book I'll get the stories for today's episode out of. I'd recommend it highly. I also want to thank the makers of Cardio Miracle and John Hewlett. It has changed my wife's and my life, and I'll talk more about it at the end of the episode. Thanks for watching. In the mid-1990s, we had one Polynesian ordnance worker, Sonny Makazini, at the Provo Temple. By the time our temple closed, 27 years later, we had over 100 Polynesian ordnance workers. While I was the supervisor of the Tuesday 3 shift, President Mackay would bring his Polynesian stake to our temple during my shift and fill the endowment rooms with members of his stake. They had their own Polynesian ordnance workers, and they conducted the endowment ceremonies in Samoan or Tongan, and they alternated each week. I always enjoyed sneaking downstairs to their devotionals, and I sat on the back row so I could join them in their wonderful hymns. I've come to love their people. Malole, from Apalalange. The Polynesian people are known for their powerful faith and devotion. Tonga now has the highest percentage of LDS people of any nation on earth. Over 63% of Tongans are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. One of the first Tongan missionaries to preach on the island of Ha'apai was Ketone Mila'e. He was instrumental in bringing one of the future great missionaries into the waters of baptism, Vilimami Fakataha. Vilimami was a powerful man in body and mind and served as an influential minister for the Church of Tonga. When Ketone first arrived on his mission, he went to visit this influential minister. He soon learned that Vilimami was very ill and discovered that he had over 100 coconut trees on his bush plantation. These trees had been neglected for a long time because of his illness. At that season, the ripe coconuts were dropping, but there was no one to gather them, split them, or cut out their meat to dry into copra. Selling this copra was the minister's main source of income for his family. So without saying a word, Ketone borrowed a copra knife and went to the minister's bush plantation and went to work, gathering a huge pile of coconuts. Then for 2 days and nights, he stuck to the task of splitting the coconuts and digging out the meat and laying it out to dry. After 2 days, some of the minister's family came to their bush plantation and found Ketone in the middle of the task. The old minister was so touched by the elder's act of charity that his heart was softened toward the gospel message. He finally said to him, "Malay, baptize me," which would be like me saying, "You're the man, baptize me." Vilimami then became a powerful missionary for the church and brought many of his people into the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. Ketone's selfless act of assistance to the previously hostile minister helped change the history of the church in Tonga. To my Polynesian friends, please forgive my pronunciation of these names and places. Mozese Muti was baptized when he was 14 years old and served faithfully in the church in whatever calling he received throughout his life. Mozese and his wife served many missions for the church. One of them was to preach and build chapels on the island of Niue. They worked faithfully in their labors with native and Haole missionaries. In 1938, a visiting authority, Apostle George Albert Smith, gave Mozese a blessing, promising him that if he always served faithfully, the day would come when he would be able to take his family to the temple without spending a cent of his own money, as they didn't have a lot. During that time while working on their mission, they'd become close to an elder, Charles Woodward. While attending BYU, Charles had established himself as a successful boxer. Once a month, he was matched against another pugilist at the Utah State Fairgrounds, and he was paid $50 for each fight. Attending BYU was much cheaper in the mid-50s. During these monthly bouts, Charles Woodward boxed and defeated several nationally ranked fighters. He was a great boxer, but he had no desire to make a career of the sport. During the summer of 1958, he received his call to serve in the Tongan mission. He worked alongside of Moses Emute and his wife on a building proselyting mission and came to love and respect them. LDS chapels in those days were primarily built with volunteer labor, and the missionaries were the most important volunteers. At this same time, the New Zealand temple was nearing completion. Moses and his wife talked about their dream to someday being able to travel there and be sealed for time and eternity. But theirs had been a faithful life of poverty, and there seemed no prospect that such an extravagance in their life would ever happen. As the end of Elder Woodward's mission approached, he felt like something was uncompleted. He needed to do something more. Then it hit him. He could pay for Moses and his wife's journey to the temple by boxing. He got permission from the mission president to meet with a boxing promoter, Don Meister, who he had met and taught the gospel to earlier in his mission. This promoter knew many of the opponents Elder Woodward had fought during his time at BYU and recognized he had great ability. After Charles explained his intentions to the boxing promoter, Meister agreed to arrange and promote a match in February of 1958 between Elder Charles J. Woodward and the Australian heavyweight champion, Ketone Lave, which would be held in Auckland, New Zealand. When Charles was released from his mission, he moved to Auckland, where he moved in with the missionaries, and he began a strict training regimen. Ketone, his opponent, was a powerful fighter. He had dominated every boxer in Tonga, then moved to New Zealand. One observer noted that he went through the Australian and New Zealand boxers like a knife through butter, adding that Ketone had the size, the strength, the speed, and he was the ideal heavyweight boxer. He would be a contender in any arena. At that time, he was the heavyweight champion of the Southern Hemisphere. Ketone agreed to the match, but he did not really take it seriously, saying he didn't have to train for this fight with a sparrow. His promoters began to refer to him as the sparrow killer. Ketone was an immensely popular fighter at the time, especially in New Zealand and Australia. So the thought of this huge Tongan powerhouse matched against a little Mormon elder attracted a huge crowd. Most of the commentators and spectators speculated that Charles didn't stand a chance against this powerful bronze Tongan. The night of the fight, as the opening bell sounded, both fighters rushed forward, and seconds later, Ketone landed a crushing blow. Charles flew back across the ring and landed on the canvas on his back. One commentator called it the most powerful punch he had ever seen. No one expected Charles could get up. He took an 8 count. Then, with superhuman strength, he staggered to his feet. The rest of the round, he spent dodging and evading his powerful opponent. Still stunned by the blow, Charles spent the next 2 rounds just surviving and trying not to be hit. But as the minutes drug on, Charles' head began to clear. By the beginning of the 4th round, his manager instructed him to take the offensive. His quickness and precision allowed him to land more and more of his punches. By the 8th round, it appeared the sparrow killer was being pecked to death. By round 12, Ketone's fate was sealed. Realizing he had lost the last 8 rounds, he tried to make up for his poor performance by swinging for the fence. but his powerful punches did not connect. They only tired him out. It was too late. Charles had withstood the power of Caetoni's punches, and with his internal stamina and precision, he had put on a boxing exhibition for 11 rounds. His performance proved him the better boxer that night. He won by decision. The next day, Charles Woodward wired Moisese and his wife, telling them that with his winnings, he had purchased tickets for Moisese and his wife to attend the New Zealand Temple dedication. The blessing of Apostle George Albert Smith was fulfilled. Moisese and his wife were sealed together for time and eternity in the newly dedicated New Zealand Temple. In 1974, Dr. Charles J. Woodward was called to be the mission president of the Tongan Mission. In 1986, Tiavata Tayamani was called to be a missionary's own leader for a cluster of islands in the northern part of Tonga, Nuku'alofa Mission. There were 8 main islands in his district, which they had to travel between to assist the missionaries in their zone. They had a small motorboat, christened the Moroni, that allowed them to travel between the islands. On November 24th, Elder Tayamani had a strong impression that they were needed on the Lulunga Islands, which were part of their zone. Their boat was in the shop for repairs, so they borrowed a boat from a member. It was an 18-foot flat-bottom boat with a 15-horse outboard motor. As they arranged to borrow the boat, everyone cautioned them and advised them to wait for better seas. The ocean was turbulent that day. But Elder Tayamai had a strong impression that those elders needed their assistance now. So the elders ignored the advice of the members, and they left the safety of their island's harbor and began weaving their way through the angry waves of the Pacific. The island of Matuku was the closest to them, about 2 miles away. As they made the crossing, huge waves crashed upon their tiny boat from all sides. They desperately negotiated the heavy seas, wondering if they should turn around. But they were driven on by the nagging feeling that they were needed on Matuku. After a perilous crossing, they finally approached the island. But the reef that formed the barrier sheltering the little bay on this island was being pounded by the lulls and swells of those turbulent seas. In this dangerous situation, the two elders felt that negotiating past the reef barrier was crazy and dangerous, so they decided to drop anchor outside the reef. And after they'd secured their little boat, as it was tossed about by the crashing waves, Elder Tayamani jumped off the back of the boat and started swimming toward shore. And almost immediately, he caught a big wave and rowed it to the beach. A group of onlookers were gathered on shore, and as Elder Tayamani waded onto the shore, the anxious islanders met him. They had a very sick sister who needed to be rushed back to Ha'afeva, where there was a hospital. The elder said he was more than happy to take her back, but wondered how they could get her onto his little boat, anchored offshore. It seemed the only possible option was for his companion to chance the heavy surf and bring their little boat into the harbor. Elder Tayamani waved and signaled for Elder Lavaka to come in. It would be a dangerous, tricky maneuver. As everyone watched anxiously from shore, the elder began the maneuver toward the reef. At a most critical moment, the motor stalled. The borrowed boat was picked up by a huge wave and slammed down hard on the reef. The elder held on, but most of the contents were ripped overboard as it came to rest on its side, wedged in the reef. In the panic of the moment, Elder Tayamani and other onlookers rushed out and righted their little boat, while others carried the sick sister out and lay her in the bottom of the boat. In the commotion, the displaced contents from the boat were lost in the turbulent waves. No one noticed that the red gas tank and the hose that fed the motor had been ripped from the boat by the impact. With great community effort, they pushed the boat off the reef back into deeper water, with the critically sick patient on board. In the chaos, neither of the missionaries noticed that their gas tank was gone, and as they started the motor and headed into the violent seas, everything went well. Looking back, Elder Tiamani said it was hard to believe, but the motor started up, and we turned the bow towards Ha'afeve, and the waters had become even uglier than they were in our earlier crossing. Now we were moving into the heavy wind and seas. The elders slowly made their way across the 2 miles separating the islands while trying to tend to their patient. The outboard motor never sputtered once. If it had, the massive waves would have proved disastrous, especially to the sick patient in the bottom of their boat. They would have either been dashed to pieces on a reef or driven out into the open ocean. But the boat and the motor performed perfectly during their perilous crossing. It was only after they were safely in the harbor and had unloaded their sick passenger that they noticed everything had been emptied from their boat as it was smashed into the reef, including their gas tank and the only fuel line feeding the motor. They had made the 2 mile crossing with no gas tank or source of fuel to their 15 horsepower outboard motor. The next morning, when the seas were calmed, the elders went back to Matuku and searched for their gas tank. They found it, hose and all, in the sandy, shallow water near the reef, somewhat dented and beat up, but still intact and full of gas. Pita Hopoate has been a prominent church leader in Tonga since the mid-70s. He's been a bishop, a stake president, a mission president, and the president of the Missionary Training Center in Tonga. In 1966, after he graduated from high school, he was called to serve in the Tongan mission and assigned to the Tungua, the western cluster of islands. Pita was concerned about this assignment because he was a terrible sailor and he couldn't swim. Determined to fulfill his call, he boarded a church-owned vessel. But before it even left the harbor, he began vomiting violently from seasickness. After some time on the water, as he hung over the side of the ship, he heard the captain comment to the first mate, "Maybe we'd better turn around and take him back. He may not even survive this crossing." Pita could not stand the thought of failing on his assignment and insisted that they continue to Tununga. Once on stable ground, he recovered from his sickness and poured himself into the work. They were responsible for many smaller islands in the island chain, and most of their travel was by outrigger canoes. Knowing he could not swim and always suffering from seasickness on the water, he constantly pled with the Lord for safety and deliverance. During the 1960s, the work in the western islands of Tonga was very difficult at best. The dangers and distance between the islands and the fragile testimonies of the few members did not bode well for a strong membership in the future. One night in 1967, on this same island, Pita went to bed overwhelmed by the hardship of his missionary service. As he slept, he dreamed a dream that left a powerful impression on him. He saw himself sitting on a beach, and suddenly the sea was full of small boats of every variety and shape. They were filled with members from the neighboring islands. He was amazed to see fathers and mothers whose children were dressed in green uniforms like those of the church-owned Liahona schools in Tonga. He watched as all these saints landed on the beach and walked up into large, beautiful church buildings. When he awoke the next morning, Pita walked down to the beach. In his mind's eye, he could still see the scene from his dream. But it seemed impossible for anything like that to ever happen at that time. However, Pita did live to witness the fulfillment of his dream. 15 years later, now as the mission president, he went to the same island to dedicate a new chapel. The church had opened a middle school on this island. After the dedication of the chapel, Pita walked down to the beach and watched as saints arrived from all the surrounding islands. They were bringing their children to enroll them in school for the upcoming year. They were the same saints he had seen in his dream 15 years earlier. While Leila Dalton was serving in Tonga on one of their missions, President David O. McKay visited the island on his way to dedicate the temple in New Zealand. He was the first president of the church to come to Tonga. Missionary labors in the islands of Tonga at that time were slow, and because of their lack of electronic recording equipment, Sister Dalton's mission president asked her if she would travel with President McKay and record his talks in shorthand. The Daltons accompanied the prophet on his ship as it traveled to the many islands of Tonga, Fiji, and Samoa. As the prophet addressed one group of saints, he said, "Last night in vision, I saw a temple in these islands." Sister Dalton was surprised and thought the prophet must have been referring to the temple in New Zealand. She thought, surely it does not mean the islands of Tonga. Many years later, she remembered this experience when the first temple in Tonga was announced. Sister Dalton was thrilled for the people of those islands. Now they could receive their saving ordinances in their own land. She'd known many members who had even sold their homes to acquire the funds to travel to distant New Zealand and receive their sealing ordinances. Today, there are 10 temples planned or operating in the Polynesian islands of that area. And anyone that's come to know the Polynesian people know what faithful, good people they are. I hope you've enjoyed these stories today. I know the Lord loves the Polynesian people. He loves all of his children, especially you. Don't ever doubt that. Sometimes we just need to feel it again. Don't be afraid to kneel down and ask the Lord, "Do you love me?" And you'll feel his love pour into your heart. If you've estranged yourself from God and have begun to doubt his existence or his love, I would encourage you to try an experiment. Think about your life. Think about the things you want to accomplish. Think about your time on this earth and what you're doing. And then think about the things that are good. Think about the things you're grateful for. Think about the blessings in your life. And then kneel down and in the name of Jesus Christ, ask God, "Are you there? Do you love me?" And I promise you, you will feel his love pour into your heart and into your mind. He knows you. He loves you. He wants you to be happy now and the rest of your life and on into eternity. Thank you for watching. I wanted to talk a little bit about Cardio Miracle. It has been amazing for me. I'm going to share some experiences that a few other people have had with Cardio Miracle. Juanita said, "I was hesitant to try Cardio Miracle. I'm very healthy and I do not eat a lot of processed food, but I decided to give it 1 month. After only 1 week, I began to notice a big difference in my energy levels. I exercise regularly, and with Cardio Miracle, I recover after a hard workout much quicker, and my muscles are not as sore. I've always been chilly as a person, but now my body is warmer. My feet and hands aren't ice cold all the time. Cardio Miracle has helped me and my circulation immensely. I have noticed several big improvements in my body's system. Thank you, Cardio Miracle." Giovanna said, "When I started on Cardio Miracle, I still drank my morning coffee a half hour afterwards, so I didn't experience the benefits of the product. I then decided to have my coffee in the afternoon. After a short time, I didn't need the pickup from my coffee at all. I'm off caffeine, which is a miracle in itself. My chronic arthritic neck and back pain have all but disappeared. My doctor told me that Cardio Miracle has reduced my inflammation and opened my vessels so the blood flow to my neck and back is improved. I recommend Cardio Miracle to everyone. James said, I have been on Cardio Miracle for 6 months now. When my doctor saw the results of my blood work last month, he was amazed. I had improved in all areas of my health. I have more energy, and my mental clarity has improved dramatically. I really love taking Cardio Miracle. I can't afford to quit taking it. I've had very similar experiences, and so has my wife. My wife has also always been a little chilly. Her hands and her feet are always cold. And since we've started on Cardio Miracle, she's not cold all the time. Her hands and her feet aren't cold when you touch them. It's been amazing. It's improved her circulation throughout her system. I've also found that it helps me rebound quicker after I've done something strenuous. If you haven't tried Cardio Miracle, it's the greatest product I've ever tried, and it is well worth it. There's not another product on the market that compares to it. There are imitations, but they don't have anywhere near the ingredients. There's 56 fruits, berries, vegetables, mushrooms, and all kinds of different organically grown things in this product that are top quality. Try it. You will be glad you did. You'll think more clearly. You'll have more energy. You'll feel younger than you felt in years. I hope you've enjoyed this episode today. I do love the Polynesian people. Kia ora to my listeners down in New Zealand. Talofa to my Samoan friends. And malolile to my Tongan friends. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can subscribe here. And if you enjoyed this episode, you'd probably enjoy this one. And you can watch all of Sunshine for the Soul, Inspirational Stories, right here. Thank you.